This is Sierra Dahl with Municipal Sustainable Energy Forum, and today we're going to be discussing electric vehicle advancement and its role in electrification. And Tom Cabot's going to start us out. He's an energy consultant in California. So go ahead, Tom.
Thank you, Sierra. One moment, let me... All right. Thank you very much. Out here in California, we've been watching the loads and trying to promote both electrification of vehicles and buildings and simultaneous greening up of the grid resources. So we now have the duck curve racing the EV adoption curve. And what's happening is with the renewable portfolio standards have gotten out ahead of the electrification a bit. And we've got around 5 or 6 gigawatts of rooftop solar now in the state behind the meter, and then about another 11 gigs of utility solar. So they're causing quite an oversupply during the day, especially on weekends, we're seeing now. And then we also have other things happening to the load where there's been the adoption of efficient lighting, which is cutting into general loads. And so we're pushing back with electrification, trying to balance things out, and definitely pushing the electric cars here in California, and seeing more need now as we look towards the long haul and trying to get California to 60% renewable portfolio standards. We see that we will need to be doing more car charging during the day, trying to simultaneously soak up that solar production so it doesn't have to be put into storage batteries overnight or other forms of load shifting. So we are starting to see what the mix looks like as we are dynamically adding all of these technologies to the grid, and it becomes more important, as we're noticing, to be able to just land the electricity once into the car each day during daylight hours as much as we can, and because every car in the future, 10 or 20 years looking out there, every car that drives home and charges at night is taking energy from a stationary battery somewhere else in the grid. And so to the extent we could have gotten that car charged up during the day, we wouldn't have had to have built the stationary batteries that hold the energy in the day and deliver it to the car at night at home. So that's one of the interesting little changes going on as you get deeper into the adaptation of EVs, solar, and efficiency technologies and other electrification that we'll be trying to do to buildings. So it's getting to be kind of an interesting horse race between all these technologies and the incentives to promote them. And then with the COVID recovery coming up, it's looking like it's going to be interesting to see what people do about mass transit versus electric vehicles. So our roads, you know, we may have a big uptake in small range electric vehicles as former mass transit users, more of them want to go to their own private vehicle. So we got a lot of moving parts going on out here, but definitely see some ideas for how to get things charged and working together. So the report from the California Duck Curve.
You were talking about a couple of new technologies. Do you want to go over those a little bit?
Oh, yeah. So also there are advances in EV charging that are going on. Some more controllable chargers and chargers that go in two directions, so bidirectional charging. Two products are on the horizon. They've both been announced and they're still in development. I think they intend to roll out later in 2020, one by Wallbox and one by Ocasio, but they're basically two-way EV chargers that allow you to power your car from your house and power your house from your car. The EV batteries have gotten to be pretty big. They are now representing, say, 4 days worth of home electric consumption in a rolling battery on wheels. And so it's probably, you know, for me, it's the more attractive way to get energy storage would be to tie an electric vehicle to the house by a two-way charger rather than getting a separate wall battery. But Anyway, so that's one of the interesting technologies. Others are going to be probably more utility interactive charging, where there's smart charging that the utility it pulses energy into the car when there's excess on the grid.
All right. Thanks, Tom. Bob Perry, do you want to spend a couple minutes here talking a little bit about what's going on again in California on EVs?
Yeah, no, this is very exciting, a very exciting area. And just this morning, I was going through my morning email, and there was just all kinds of stuff coming up regarding EV charging. There's a study that was recently released in Hawaii regarding their smart charging program out there, and the cost of electricity in Hawaii is double that of the national average in the U.S. And they were finding high rates of adoption and a compelling economic case. You know, the economic case still exists in California and other states as well. It's the advent of electrifying transportation is kind of a two-edged sword. I mean, you're going to be greatly increasing load the more EVs you get on, but you're also you also have the opportunity, as was mentioned, to use the cars as a buffering element in the overall grid charging infrastructure. And it's going to be really important for there to be incentives, not only for homeowners, but employers, because a lot of people, they'll be working, I mean, especially when the COVID resolves itself, will be working at having their cars at work and will need to be charged. And there are going to need to be incentives for employers to put solar on their property, or for people just to be able to charge anywhere during the day during these excess periods, and to receive some kind of monetary incentive for that. But the Hawaii report was really interesting, because it just kind of spelled out, the unique relationship between cars. It cites the average daily household use is 28.5 kilowatt hours. A Nissan Leaf, 2019 Nissan Leaf, has 62 kilowatt hours. So with a fully charged Nissan Leaf using these new two-way charging systems, the house could be function for 2 days on a full charge. You have new trucks coming online. The Rivian truck will have 180 kilowatt hours. So there you've got that. You multiply that by three. Yeah, a house could remain functional for almost a week on a truck. And so there's a huge resilience benefit from having these types of systems. I also want to give a shout out to a colleague, John Sarter, who's working with Asiaco in Fairfax, and they're constructing a small microgrid system using these two-way charging technologies in a residence. And it'll be very interesting to see, all the benefits that will accrue from that. So there's a tremendous amount of potential and promise for transportation, but also challenges, that because there's going to be a huge uptick in load, and which will require a lot of infrastructure investment.
All right. Thank you. Chris Carrick, you're on the line. Would you want to tell us a little bit about what's happening up in your area in New York? And I know Ron came himself from New York, but go ahead, Chris.
Okay. I wasn't aware that I was going to be presenting, but I can certainly talk for a couple of minutes. In New York, folks may know that we passed last year the Climate Leadership and Community Protection Act, which went into effect January 1. That has set forward some pretty ambitious climate protection goals, greenhouse gas emissions reduction goals. And folks may know that transportation is the largest and the fastest growing share of greenhouse gas emissions in New York State, despite the fact that New York City is so reliant on electrified public transportation. Here in upstate New York, we drive quite a lot, and that helps to drive emissions, but really the reliance on truck transportation for delivery of goods is a major factor there as well. So the Climate Action Council, which was established by that legislation, has just begun to meet, and it's their charge to lay out the roadmap for how the state is going to reach its goals. And I expect that transportation will be a major focus of that council. They've had one meeting so far. They're meeting again next Thursday, I believe. And hopefully they'll begin to dig into that work. Meanwhile, the state is part of a 12-state compact in Northeast and Mid-Atlantic states, including the District of Columbia, called the Transportation and Climate Initiative, which the goal of which is to work together to reduce emissions in the transportation sector. And they've laid out some principles through a memorandum of understanding for just to stand up a cap and invest program. It's somewhat modeled on the REGI, or Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative program for power plants, but this would apply to obviously for the transportation sector. So that would impose polluter fees at various points in the distribution system, from wholesalers to distributors to retailers, collect those funds, and then, as the name implies, invest in clean energy or clean transportation infrastructure. And like REGI, the cap gets smaller over time, and again, those proceeds would be used to invest in the infrastructure that we need. So the other thing maybe that I would mention is proceeding in the Public Service Commission. The Department of Public Service staff put forward a plan in January of this year to provide monies for infrastructure, so both Level 2 and DC fast charging infrastructure, really to prepare those sites to be ready to accept charging infrastructure. So that's an important move forward. But folks may have seen a recent blog post from the Environmental Defense Fund, which sort of criticizes that DPS plan for really ignoring buses, public transit, and trucks, which again is a very large component. And I think folks on this call are aware of, you know, the extra considerations that are required to put infrastructure in place to, for example, meet the goals that the New York City MTA has put forward, and which the governor has charged all the upstate regional transit agencies to put forward similar plans to electrify their buses. So I guess in summary, you know, we're making strides forward, but still quite a long way to go. You know, I think I certainly agree with all the comments that have been made about vehicle to grids, vehicle to building benefits in terms of resilience. But I think that needs to be accounted for in proceedings like the one I mentioned with the Public Service Commission, to be able to capture all of those co-benefits to help make the financial case for use of public ratepayer funds to put into that infrastructure. So I guess I'll stop there. And I guess Ron certainly can chime in if I've missed any important pieces here in New York.
Thanks, Chris. Chris is with the Central New York Regional Planning Board, just for reference. Okay, Ron. Why don't you tell us what's happening on your end?
Thanks so much. It's really a pleasure and an honor, especially with Tom and Bob and Chris on the line. I thought Chris did an outstanding job, as did Tom and Bob. So, like, as just to follow up on Chris's piece, you know, in New York State, as he mentioned, there's the our goal is to reach 100% clean everything by 2050 with certain steps along the way. Transportation right now is somewhere between 30 and 40% of all the greenhouse gases. So we can't get anywhere near the goal without dealing with transportation. And it's $25 billion a year of current expenses that all New York State spends on transportation fuels. So it's both an environmental opportunity and need, as well as an economic cost that we can start to eat into. And as Chris mentioned, you know, there's a lot going on in New York, but I do have to say we always defer to California. As Tom and Bob said, your leadership is just outstanding. And, you know, we don't have the current duck curve issues that you got, because we're still building all the infrastructure that we need to have in place with solar to be able to start to think that we can reduce the peak and be able to charge during the day. Right now, the main goal is to have people really charge at night when New York has a lot of excess capacity. And that's kind of part of the one step forward. The good part is, as Chris said, I think, is that there's $650 million worth of incentive programs that is part of the $5 billion clean energy fund that New York State has. And then there's another $250 million that the New York Power Authority has to develop some high-speed charging infrastructure too, which is all great, I think. You know, it's definitely a step in the right direction. The real question becomes, as we look at this, how do we kind of follow some of the pieces that California has put into place? You know, I was really amazed to see Southern California Edison come out with that pathway 2045 a few years ago, or last year, I think it was, that said that if we electrify everything and do certain things that California is already headed towards, that the average annual energy spend for the average customer would fall by a third. So to me, that's a really good sign, especially in the post-COVID world when everybody is coming out of really economic situation here. If we can make the case and show and prove that we can save money by doing all this electrification, beneficial electrification, we'll be in a really good place with everybody. And I think the opportunity is there. One of the things that I've been promoting for a long time, and I'm still not quite sure, and I'd like to hear from everybody about why. 98% of most people's trips across the country are less than 100 miles. And as I think it was Bob, or I'm not sure if it was Bob or Tom, pointed out, you know, in Hawaii, they documented that you take a Nissan Leaf and the amount of electricity that it uses to drive around is less than half of its capacity. So 98% of the time, people can plug into their house, drive whatever they need to do, come back, plug back into their house, and not have to worry about it. And in New York, that's a great opportunity because we don't have the duck curve where we have to use that excess electricity yet during the day. So therefore, using that excess capacity at night makes a tremendous amount of sense. When we reach California's piece of having excess capacity during the day, then you can shift that from the homeowner down to the workplace and wherever folks are driving to get that during the day. But my question is, as I've been listening to the manufacturers, GM and others, talk about electric vehicles and how they're still committed to electric vehicles, I guess the question is, why aren't we just pushing the fact that we don't have to wait for infrastructure to get built out to be able to have 98% of our trips covered by just plugging into our homes or at a workplace?
Okay, was that a question?
Yeah, I'd love to hear everybody's perspectives on it. So, because to me, it's been the sort of simplest, easiest thing to put out there is that, look, you know, while we're building the infrastructure, while we have all this investment in infrastructure, which we need to do and to make that systematic piece, but 98% of the time, you don't need it. I mean, wherever you live, as long as there's a charging station where you live or where you work, that's what you need. And if you do that, and California is a little bit different from most other places, but if you do that,
you know, we don't have to wait for the infrastructure. We can just have this massive shift today.
Interesting idea. I have a question for everybody on that. What is the development now of solar charging stations? So I'm just going to throw that out there as well. So anybody else have any comments on this? Craig, you're always good for one, and I know we have Jeff Tinsky on here who's a solar developer, so any thoughts about that? Jeff, I'll unmute you. Jeff, are you there?
Yeah, can you hear me?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay, so I'm muted. Anyway, I don't have a big picture comment, I guess. I actually have an electric vehicle. It's a plug-in hybrid, Chevy Volt, nothing fancy. And I've got a reasonably long commute. The crazy thing that I just don't understand is that at my workplace, there's electric vehicle chargers, but they charge somewhere between 30 and 40 cents a kilowatt hour midday. And why either the PUC or the utilities themselves don't put some significantly discounted rate for EV charging for midday when we have the excess energy and the wholesale prices for energy spring, summer, fall anyway are damn near zero in California. That they can put it, 5 cents, 10 cents a kilowatt hour and really incentivize charging midday versus, paying, it's cheaper for me to run on gas most of the time if I'm paying 30 or 40 cents a kilowatt hour. So, I do almost all my charging at home because it doesn't make sense economically to charge at work. And, again, I think this is an area for policy work that just would require, the utilities to offer a very aggressive daytime charging rate, especially in places like California and parts of the Northeast where solar penetration is becoming significant. Oh, hello. Can you still hear me?
Hear you. Craig, yeah. I see that you're online. Do you have any thoughts about that, Craig, or anybody else? Or Artie, I see you're there too.
Well, this is Tom. I think the last speaker is definitely pointing out that we've got policies and economic incentives lagging where they need to be to have a convergence where there's a smooth operation into the future and where we send customers the right signals. And as a utility planner for a long time, I kind of worry about dealing with the public and how the public hates to have a signal reversed. And so it kind of makes sense to try to figure out what is the long-term signal and start sending them that one now so that you won't have to reverse it later. When it becomes the case you need. And so, we have these situations where the peak for California used to be during the daylight too. Our problem time was during daylight, and now our problem time is at night. Also, our problem time has always been in the summer so far. It will go into the winter. So we will need to be eventually incenting people to insulate their buildings better, essentially to get us through the winter when we'll be short on wind and solar, still trying to meet these very high renewable percentages. So we've got problems of lagging policies compared to where they need to be and compared to where they should be right now. So that's a challenge to us all, is how do we catch up?
Artie, do you have any thoughts about this? You should be unmuted, Artie, if you want to talk. All right. Anybody else here? If
you're not, this is Chris Carrick again. Oh, sorry.
Sure. No, go ahead.
you had asked about solar-powered EV charging, I think.
Right.
Just wanted to point folks to Envision Solar, which has a product called the EV Arc, which is a solar PV canopy integrated with level 2 charging. They, I think last summer, delivered 50 units to New York City for the city's EV fleet, and have been doing, you know, business with a number of other municipalities as well. So it's an interesting product. It's not cheap by any means, but has a lot of interesting features, and including some measure of portability. So I think I read an article where some cities had actually moved these things around in response to the COVID and quarantine situation. So interesting product, people might want to check out.
Yeah, this is Ron. I agree with Chris. The EV Arc is from Envision, which actually comes out of San Diego. Thank you, California. Is a great product. It really helps in those areas where you have grid constraints, where the cost to get the wiring and do the hookups in particular is high. So that's where they've been actually making a tremendous amount of success. But then, as Chris also mentioned, they're semi-portable. So you basically just go pick them up, put them on a truck, flatbed, bring them wherever you go. And actually, just yesterday, they came out with a version that can handle floodwaters up to 10 feet without destroying the unit, which in a lot of locations now, as we get more and more climate events, is going to be really critical because, you know, if you have 6 or 8 feet of floodwater, it usually would wipe out your charging station and destroy it. And now they have a product that everything is up at 10 feet, and therefore it'll be much more resilient. So it's a definitely fascinating, great product out of San Diego, and I think we're going to see a lot more of that wherever there's grid constraints or wherever there's flooding issues. In terms of the rest of your point, I think, you know, one of the really interesting things, again, from California and somewhat from Hawaii, I suppose, is that as we get more and more solar on the grid, I thought you guys just the last, I think it was Bob, or maybe it was Tom, sorry, that mentioned that, you know, having the right signals to consumers is a really interesting discussion. I mean, you know, right now, my perspective is that we need to get as many electric vehicles on the road as soon as possible, let people understand in New York that it's a cost-effective way. You're still looking at a comparable price of $1 a gallon, which in most parts of the state and many parts of the country is still about half the price of gasoline for a comparable vehicle, a gas vehicle. So there's ways to save fuel costs, there's ways to save maintenance and operation costs. There's ways to, with the incentives now, to be able to buy it even as cheap or cheaper than a gas vehicle, and we need to get more of them on the road. In New York, the way the current grid is set up, the opportunity really is to charge at night. So for most people who live in single-family detached homes, which is about half the state, have an electric vehicle, plug it into your garage or plug it into your house overnight with a regular electric socket, does 98% of your trips, and therefore we can take out almost half of the vehicles in New York State, convert them to gas without any additional infrastructure, and do it at night. But I thought, again, the conversation about shifting policies over time and having consumers pay attention or get different signals is really a fascinating one that will be really, I'm kind of curious to see how that evolves, because it is really, California really is a leader in terms of looking at that and helping to make that, figure out that scenario and help us to adjust consumers.
All right. James Ornstein out of Texas. Do you have any comments on this? You're unmuted, James, if you want to talk. I mean, unless you have your phone muted. Okay. Feel free to chime in if you want to. Michael Walton, any thoughts on this out of Tennessee? Anything going on there?
Yeah. Hey, this is this is Michael Walton in Chattanooga, Tennessee. We've had a lot of investment in electric vehicle infrastructure here, going back to the 80s and 90s with electric buses. One of the things that we've really been struggling with is trying to figure out the sort of equity lens on this discussion and how we get electric vehicles in the most vulnerable communities. Because all of the benefits that the previous speaker was just talking about, you know, really make it a good argument in terms of lowering total cost of ownership, improving reliability. You know, all of those are things that our low-income neighborhoods need, and unfortunately in a city like Chattanooga, our mass transit is abysmal. So, you know, it's people are very, you know, in the high 90% are still largely dependent on cars here. So, you know, trying to figure out what the right ways are to get penetration of electric vehicles in low to moderate income households, I think is a real challenge. And we have some ideas about, you know, how to structure sort of like used EV cooperatives that can do sort of wholesale purchasing and also reduce the risk for battery replacement, but we haven't been able to get it off the ground. So I don't really have a good answer, but if anybody else does, I would love to hear it.
Yeah, don't wait to be called on. If you want to speak, just dive in right now. So we have several people who are muted. Just do a 4 and then a star and unmute the line and feel free to talk. So any thoughts about that, Ron?
So, you know, I agree with the with Michael that dealing with the equity issues are really important, especially since when you take a look at where in New York, anyway, a lot of the air pollution is, it's mostly from transportation through those low and moderate income communities. And that's where you see the highest rates of asthma and the highest other health impacts from transportation. So absolutely agree. I think it's a really interesting question. I think that I love the idea of that cooperative, especially on the use piece. The other way to go might be thinking about leasing. I'm looking right now at a Hyundai Ioniq 2019 that for a 3-year, 30,000 miles, which would do most people's driving, $79 a month with a $1,000 do it signing, but $79 a month. I mean, that becomes pretty affordable. Just take a look. It may be that if we can get some financial people to start presenting some decent lease offers, there's green banks, there's other socially responsible investment funds. I think that might be a really interesting way of going if we can start convincing some of these larger socially responsible investors to put up funds for low-income leases. I think that might be a good step in the right direction.
Yeah, I totally agree. That's the direction that we're moving right now is looking at a potential green bank.
Yeah, I love that idea. This is Chris in Syracuse. I think the New York Green Bank, as an example, really needs to get involved with this, although they've shied away from retail sort of level lending, so we'd have to figure out, you know, how do we work within their model. But one thing we've been thinking about is trying to put together an aggregation opportunity similar to our Solarize campaign or the campaign we're running now for heat pumps, our Heat Smart CNY campaign. I know this has been done in Boulder, Colorado, and some other places where you work with car dealers to offer discounts if a certain number of people sign up. I think that's a little challenging in a place like New York where we often have a hard time getting supply. I don't know what it's like in Chattanooga. But the other thing I would just say is that at least in New York City, you know, the issue around PM 2.5 and health-related issues is mostly caused by trucks, diesel burning trucks and buses. And so, again, I don't know what it's like in Chattanooga, but as an urban planner, you know, if you've got highways running through low-income neighborhoods with a lot of truck traffic, that's not going to be necessarily impacted strongly by encouraging individual, you know, low-income folks to switch to EVs.
Yeah, this is Bob Perry. I'd like to make a few points. Definitely there's an environmental justice element to all of this. The California Air Resources Board has been focusing on the impacts from trucking, diesel trucking, both in the ports and in the communities located along the freeways. And they're contemplating putting an advanced clean truck rule, which would mandate that truck manufacturers sell increasing percentage of zero emission trucks. There's also a medium to heavy duty vehicle proceeding happening in California as to how to incentivize that. And I think that as you get into these larger vehicle formats, that the fuel cells, particularly in the trucking industry that runs on a tight schedule, the fuel cell technologies really play to the larger vehicles. So that kind of brings into play an interconnection with the need for longer duration energy storage for grid services. So there's a lot of interconnection going on here between transportation, environmental justice, and grid resiliency and reliability. Also, to the point that 98% of vehicle travel is under 100 miles, that's a very cogent point. In California, though, range anxiety is very much alive due to the size of the state and the fact that people are always thinking about the drive up to San Francisco from L.A. or from the Bay Area down to L.A. or San Diego. And it raises an interesting point that perhaps maybe what the car manufacturers could do would be to offer their vehicle, but then also have like a long-range alternative that would be available on demand as needed as part of the lease package, so that a car owner would be confident that, you know, they could drive the smaller vehicle or the lower range vehicle, but have the option of having access to a long-range vehicle when needed. And finally, an idea that's been floated out a lot that I like is the idea that you can sell a car, but not include the cost of the battery in the sales price, and then utilize the battery for grid services. And that might be especially attractive for fleet vehicles and things of that nature, and would really reduce the purchase cost of a vehicle. So, I mean, there's a lot of great ideas out there.
This is Tom. I think that was Bob was the last speaker, and I think that idea of the long-range vehicle access as part of a lease is a great one. I think Fiat offered that a number of years ago on one of their leases, where you had one day a month, you got an extra day a month credit to borrow a long-range vehicle each month, and you could accumulate those credits and stack them up. So it was kind of starting to look at that as mobility as a service provided through a vehicle lease. And then thinking about the kind of the PM 2.5 and local air quality problems in a lot of our neighborhoods. If there's a way to work on the last package mile delivery and try to rapidly convert that to electric, both through the Postal Service and the delivery vans that are going on for all the private delivery, that seems like such an easy way to take a lot of idling PM 2.5 and start-stop out of the air. And so, you know, I wonder what is the leverage we have, and is there a role for cities in that action or states? You know, how do we work together on helping the conversion and maybe keeping the Postal Service more economic by having a lower cost of vehicle?
One second here. I'd like to, Norm, do you want to say something, Norm Luchtfeather?
Yes, I guess I have a long history in solar, but I've been sort of observing electric vehicles. Who in Maryland, and I live in Annapolis, Maryland, who in Maryland seems to be familiar with the group that is on the phone right now? And it would be easy for me to contact anybody and even, you know, meet with them after COVID-19, of course. But my feeling is we have so much going on with electric vehicles in Maryland with BG&E and Constellation, and just we have electric vehicle shows here in Annapolis. So there's a lot going on in electric vehicles. Who do you have as contacts here? And maybe Sierra can send that email to me. If, you don't have to give it to me now, but Sierra has my email address, and I'd be happy to receive anything and contact anybody that you have, because I can do it on my own. But who is the contact group that you know of in Maryland?
Ron, any thoughts?
There's a guy in D.C. who's really excellent. I'm not sure he's more of a kind of national EV expert, but I'll reach out to him, and I'll see. He may be a good contact. So.
Okay.
Okay, and Ron's contact information is on the email, so you can
yep.
go ahead and reach out to him that way.
Right.
This is Mike. Oh, go ahead.
Ron, your cell is 917-453?
Yes, sir.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. No, go ahead, Michael. Yeah,
I wanted to follow up on the last question about the sort of postal service. So I had the pleasure of meeting DHL's sustainability director, I think it was last year in Nashville. And for those that don't know, DHL actually runs all of the local postal service in Germany. So they are basically like Germany's U.S. Postal Service. And so they have been converting all of their last mile vehicles to electric and are in the process of converting their heavy trucks to electric.
Wow, that was great. I didn't know that about DHL. I knew that Amazon... Yeah, no, it's really amazing. I mean, I knew that Amazon has an order for 100,000 Rivians, and that they're going to be moving systematically toward getting their delivery programs towards their own, you know, sort of from beginning to end, kind of nuts to nuts. But that's great to know about mm-hmm. DHL. That's happening all throughout the states, huh?
Well, so all of their last mile trucks in Germany are actively shifting to electric. They've already started that. I think the heavy trucks are sort of in a similar boat as Amazon, where they have them on order and will be integrating them as they, you know, roll out. However, I think they have converted some number of their yard trucks to electric. So those are the trucks that they use at shipping transfer facilities to sort of shuffle trailers around.
Is that happening in the States too, or just in Germany?
Uh-huh. I believe the yard truck thing has happened or is happening in the States. The presentation was a while ago, so my memory of the details is a little bit blurry.
Okay. Benny, did you want to say something? Let's see, your line's unmuted. Nope. Okay, one thing, if I do mute your line, it's because I'm trying to track down the background noise. It doesn't mean I'm trying to keep you from saying something. So just to let you know that. So if you want to talk, go ahead and do a star or four and a star to unmute your line. Anything else here?
Sierra, this
yeah.
is Richard Case.
Oh, hi, Richard. Uh-huh.
Two small things are municipal utility, we're working with our umbrella organization, the Mass Municipal Wholesale Electric, and we are rolling out controlled charging, level two charging stations for home use, so that when there's a grid peak load, we can suspend the charging of EVs. And the other one is Concord, Mass., is looking at electric school buses, both for environmental but also load management and resiliency, because, of course, the capacity of the batteries in an electric school bus are many times what a car is. And so they're looking at that as backup power, mobile backup power. So if they need backup power, they drive the buses to whatever town facility and plug it in a vehicle to grid.
That sounds interesting.
Yeah, this is Ron. Ron again. So yeah, there's been a pilot going on in New York, in Westchester, White Plains, actually, where they have five school buses that are doing something just like that, where Con Ed has invested in some of the two-way charging infrastructure with the school buses to see if it's possible to both have resiliency as well as peak reduction impacts. And I think that's going to be a really fascinating place to be. To me, it seems like the heavy duty, especially school buses, since they're not used during the summer, is can provide a great peak reduction resource, because most of those buses aren't used during the summer, so you just charge them either with solar or at night, and then you have that power to impact onto the grid, and you have a resource that those buses that aren't being used, and that's a tremendous opportunity. There's still cost constraints that are holding things at this point, but I think we're seeing more and more buses across more and more schools, more and more states are interested in it from all the different perspectives, because also moving kids around is obviously, you know, we want to have a positive impact on their health too.
Right. So this is one they're still working out all of the economic details, because of one cost comes out of one budget, one comes out of another budget, and all of those different places that they have to merge together. So that's one of the things that they're working on. Concord is a municipal utility.
Hey, Alan, do you have anything to say about Florida, Alan Brand? Anybody else?
Yeah, this is Bob Perry. One topic that hasn't been touched on is the whole movement or the idea of transitioning to a shared mobility, multimodal shared mobility system, and how we can incentivize people to, you know, ditch their cars and use mass transit, particularly, you know, during longer commutes. That's a whole other issue that has to be explored. Also, a study came out last year that actually found that the prevalence of Lyft and Uber cars within San Francisco actually led to an increase in emissions, because you have all these cars just kind of driving around looking for rides, and Lyft just recently announced that they would be electrifying their fleet by 2030. I'm not sure how they can do that, because they don't really they don't buy the cars for their drivers, so they're going to have to require drivers to have EVs or something, which raises some legal concerns. But, you know, this is another aspect of the transportation system that has to be considered as well, as the fact that, you know, we need to try to incentivize more use of mass transit, but that requires a multimodal system that gets you to that last mile that can get you there. So that's another interesting topic concerning EVs.
Yeah, this is Ron. I absolutely agree. Oh, go ahead, Tom.
Oh, I also was going to agree. And
mentioned that out here in California, Peninsula Clean Energy, the local CCA where I live, has put together a program that offers a weekly incentive to Lyft drivers who have electric cars and are charging them. So that's one of the ways they're trying to encourage them, because that problem that was just pointed out, what the deadheading problem of Lyft-type cars or shared mobility cars still driving around looking for rides does have definitely a raised emission factor. And so electrifying those high-mileage cars would be a great air pollution reducer.
Yeah, this is Chris Carrick. If you look into the details on the Lyft announcement yesterday, I don't think it was in the New York Times article, but some of the other outlets covered the fact that Lyft is not planning to provide any incentives to help their drivers switch to EVs, and they're basically going to use their bully pulpit to try to get states and, I guess, cities to provide, you know, incentives to help their drivers make that switch. So, you know, whether they're doing enough, I guess, is a matter for debate, but I do think cities can and should do more to kind of put mandates and requirements in place, as well as incentives.
Yeah, this is Ron. I think in addition to the mandates and the incentives, the other piece that anyone with mass transit can do is there are a lot of lines that are either underutilized or very poorly utilized, especially on the last miles. And it would behoove all of us if there was an integrated computerized system that says, hey, you know, we're moving people. We're going to guarantee you can get from A to B or A to B to C. And with B to C, we'll be able to do mass transit on a bus or train or whatever else. But A to B, we have an integrated system. We'll send out an electric vehicle, Lyft, Uber, whoever, that will pick you up, make sure you can get there. And by coordinating all of that, we can reduce air pollution and I believe reduce costs too.
Yeah, this is Bob Perry again. LA Metro is working on a program that would have like a unified app, a phone app that covers all the different mobility services that would be available. So, for example, you could, if you were in LA, and I'm in Santa Barbara, a lot of people come up to Santa Barbara. There's a huge congestion problem during the peak, the summer months. But if you could incentivize a family to take the train up, and knowing full well that there were e-bikes or EVs or scooters or whatever they wanted, plus you could have portage companies taking their luggage to the hotel once they got off the train, it's the ability to offer a coordinated response that is reliable is going to be a huge challenge. But there needs to be some kind of a common interface via a phone app or something like that.
Yeah, folks may be interested. The city of Ithaca, folks in the city of Ithaca who run the car share program have been putting that kind of app-based platform together. So it's an interesting pilot folks might want to look into.
Anything else?
Well, one of the things I think that's going to help along the way is as we move on policy as well as cost effectiveness towards having these trucks and heavier duty buses, et cetera, come out and have EV charging and be able to deliver a lot of power to those fleets, being able to integrate the charging infrastructure from those fleets with the ability to do the masses, I think, is going to be really important and key as well. And you can get the economics from running the fleet and then have the extra availability of those fast charges for the rest of the public at off times. And I think off times from the fleets, which generally need the energy during the day but are charging at night. So I think that's a really an interesting area to think about as well.
Okay.
Sierra, this is Tom. Just thinking about one more way to help make the transition. In part of my work here, I help people look at the stranded asset problem of making these last fossil commitments and trying to avoid that, because we know here in California that every time we buy a fossil asset, it's stranded, and we don't have the climate space to run it to the end of its life. So how do we help or encourage or whatever the folks who maintain the fossil fleets right now to not buy any more of those vehicles, but just to keep their existing ones running a couple of years longer until the Rivians and the whatevers are there to replace them? And so, you know, how do you avoid getting these Model 2020 and Model 2021 fossil vehicles stranded into fleets? You know, how do we encourage the maintenance and the mechanics to keep it all running and the purchasers not to purchase?
Good question, Ron. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Boy, carrots and sticks, right? So incentives on one side and mandates on the other.
Well, one thing our agency has been doing is trying to help our municipalities do long-range planning for their fleets, both in terms of assessing the suitability of integrating EVs and also right-sizing their fleets. We believe strongly that the public sector can lead by example, and if folks see, you know, branded EVs owned by their municipality driving around community, there's that demonstration effect that we've seen with solar PV, but these municipalities need a lot of help and support. We've been doing a lot of research into how to provide that support cost effectively. So I don't know if other folks on the line have worked with public or private fleets in this regard, but I think that's really an important piece of the puzzle.
Yeah, this is Ron. Chris, I absolutely agree with you. One of the things that we did in Westchester was identify and work with and set up programs for the municipal fleets. We can quintuple the amounts of electric vehicles in the municipal fleets, and there is no doubt that having those fleets drive around branded EVs helped raise public awareness, get people more understanding, and the great part was that they were saving money, so the total cost of ownership went down, and they were able to justify it and then help get the word out that way to all their constituents too. So it absolutely makes total sense.
Anybody else?
Yeah, this is Bob Peary. I think one really important thing, you know, from a sociological standpoint, is to get more people into EVs. To get them to experience driving an EV. And I think, you know, getting the rental car companies to you know, really focus on expanding their EV fleet so that people can actually experience firsthand, it'll make them a lot more likely to buy an EV in their next purchase. So that's kind of a hurdle, is just getting people into EVs to experience the feel of driving them, which is pretty fun. You know, I mean, they're really fun cars to drive. And so that's another area that needs to be explored.
All right, more thoughts on that? Well, it looks like we're on time. So if we have another speaker here or another person who would like to chime in, one last thought. No? Okay. So thanks, everybody, for coming. Thanks for our panelists for their information. And I'll be sending out calendar invites for the July conference calls probably within the next week. And also, we have a webinar on the 15th where Samuel Golding is going to be talking about options for structuring the community choice energy programs. So hope to see you all there, and thanks again for everybody for coming.
Thank you.
Thanks, everybody. Great conversation.
Thanks.